Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. I have been enormously impressed over the past few years in the work and the energy of our first guest. He is a national security analyst for ClarionProject.org, a frequent contributor to Fox News and other news outlets, an adjunct professor of homeland security at Liberty University, and a duty expert on the Muslim Brotherhood and the sort of civilization jihad in which it is engaged. His name is Ryan Morrow, and it's always a pleasure to welcome him to this program, but particularly in the wake of some very important revelations that you have come up with, Ryan, and shared with Glenn Beck's audience earlier in the week, concerning a fellow we talk about here from time to time, and I know you've been as concerned about as I have been, namely Grover Norquist, an anti-tax activist who actually has a book coming out today, I'm told, on the IRS and taxes, but who has an ominous sideline to his work over the past 17 years or so. Talk a bit about that phenomenon and what you've uncovered today.
Sure. Well, the backstory is, of course, the Muslim Brotherhood operates in the United States. They set up a series of front organizations, as you've done wonderful work exposing, and one such operative was Sami Al-Aryan, who is later convicted of being a terrorist. When you look at his indictment, it says that he did seek to obtain support from influential individuals in the United States under the guise of promoting and protecting Arab rights. So it's specifically stated that these different groups, spearheaded by Sami Al-Aryan and his colleagues, were using the supposed cause of civil rights in order to gain access to the highest levels of the political parties. Now, one of the people that they used in order to obtain that access is Grover Norquist. He formed the Islamic Free Market Institute in the 1990s. He did so with the assistance and collaboration of various other Muslim Brotherhood-linked organizations that we know from declassified FBI documents, Muslim Brotherhood documents, and together they started working for the Bush campaign. You can look at these exact organizations and see how they endorse and even finance the Bush campaign.
This would have been the 2000 presidential campaign for George W. Bush.
Right, in 2000. And what's really stunning about all of this is that we now have documents from the Bush White House that tell a very interesting story about what was supposed to happen on 9/11. Everyone talks about the intelligence failure of the attacks that happened on 9/11, but not the intelligence failure of the meetings that were supposed to happen on 9/11.
Talk a bit about those, and particular this sort of cause celeb that Sami Al-Aryan had, as you say, under the guise of protecting civil rights of Arabs and Muslims, namely what he called secret evidence. What was that about, and what was he trying to do, among other things, on that particular day?
Sure. Sami Al-Aryan and his friends wanted his brother-in-law, a fellow terrorist and Brotherhood operative connected to Palestinian Islamic Jihad, to be released. He was detained based on this practice of what's called secret evidence, where an immigrant could be detained on national security grounds but not be given that very sensitive national security information, very understandably so.
Because by so doing, you would risk compromising not only the data itself, obviously, the information that implicated that individual, but also possibly the sources and methods by which it would be obtained, right?
Right. And so it's a legitimate national security concern, but Sami Al-Aryan and his friends decided to turn it into a civil rights issue, and they started rallying people to their side to endorse that issue by saying that this was key to winning Muslim and Arab support, and we can deliver that for you if you adopt our position. And that's what the Bush campaign did. And that's not speculation. When you look at the endorsement of Bush's campaign, they specifically say that his adoption of that position, as well as the access they were given, was due to his adoption of this position, and that's why they endorsed him.
You know, one of the things, just an important detail here, and again, our guest is Ryan Morrow. He is a national security analyst for the Clarion Project, and you can find his work at clarionproject.org. But as you know, Ryan, one of the things that was really quite extraordinary in terms of the quid pro quo between the Sami Alarian team on the Muslim Brotherhood side on the one hand and the Bush campaign on the other, in an arrangement brokered by Grover Norquist, was something that the Wall Street Journal published, I believe, in 2003, in which it described Grover Norquist boasting that not once but twice during the campaign debate between Al Gore and then Governor Bush, Karl Rove called Grover Norquist to make sure that the Muslim team that Grover was working with, including Alarian and Abdurrahman Alamoudi and other convicted terrorists and so on, actually understood that the president candidate president to be had made the commitment to do something about secret evidence. Talk a bit about what that suggests was, in fact, Norquist's role, which he is now adamantly denying, among other places, again, to Glenn Beck, who has done a very serious and I think quite rigorous investigation of Norquist's many ties to these guys and the help that he's been providing them, even to this day.
Well, Sami Alarian gave Grover Norquist an award for taking up this cause because he so appreciated what he had done. And Sami Alarian, one of the organizations he was linked to and he actually said was essentially his own, is a group called IIIT, the International Institute of Islamic Thought, which has all sorts of ties to Grover Norquist's organization. Now, that group is also linked to the Muslim Brotherhood.
That organization would, again, be, just for the record, the Islamic Free Market Institute, which he helped set up with money from this fellow Abdurrahman Alamoudi. Is that right?
Right. So to summarize, you have Sami Alarian, who says that this group, IIIT, is basically his own. And we now know from declassified FBI documents all the way back in the 80s that the FBI had an informant inside the Muslim Brotherhood that said, watch out, IIIT is setting up political action front groups to, and this is a quote, peacefully get inside the United States government. And they were already boasting success. So there really is no speculation here. This was a political influence operation. It's spelled out and admitted so in these files. And it culminates in this really dramatic meeting that was supposed to happen on 9/11. We have President Bush's schedule and the guest list to show that this was to happen and the purpose of this meeting where he would fly from Florida to Washington, D.C. and meet with a large group of Islamists, including three attendees from Norquist's organization, was to discuss secret evidence, the issue that Sami Alarian and his allies were pushing, as well as Middle East policy, racial profiling, and those other issues. But the top one was secret evidence.
Now, Ryan, as you look at this, the evidence that you've compiled and the broader dossier, copies of which can be obtained, by the way, for free at securefreedom.org. It's a booklet we call Agent of Influence, Grover Norquist and the Assault on the Right, in addition to your own very important work at theclarionproject.org. But summarize, if you would, what, in your estimation, was the extent and nature of Grover Norquist's role? He denies any involvement with these guys. And what, more to the point, was its impact?
Well, Norquist's role in arranging these different relationships only was denied relatively recently. It was reported at the time, and we know that James Zogby said that this happened. So this was widely understood, and again, the same individuals that were involved with Norquist's organization are the same ones advancing this cause and meeting with the administration, but most specifically, on the attendee side of the 16 activists, three of them were active officials from Norquist's organization, and on the White House side, of the seven White House officials that were to participate in these meetings, three of those came from Norquist's organization. So what you see is the influence of Norquist's group in arranging the media from the meeting from the White House side as well as from the attendee side. So he had the strongest hand at the table in arranging those meetings. And by the way, of the 16 activists that are listed, 14 of them have links to the Muslim Brotherhood, Alamoudi, and Sami Alarian.
Ryan, there's so much more to talk about here. I hope we'll have a chance to do so again soon. I commend to all of you Ryan Morrow's terrific work at clarionproject.org. Also, check out his appearance recently on Glenn Beck's program and We will shortly have a kind of highlights of Glenn Beck's investigation into the Norquist caper, and we will call attention to that in subsequent programs. But in the meantime, Ryan, thank you for your terrific work. Keep it up and come back to us again very soon. Next up, we'll speak with Diana West. We'll take stock with her about the Islamization of Europe and a man who's trying to stand up against it there. Here at Wilders, straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
I'm Jim Hansen of Secure Freedom, formerly the Center for Security Policy. Welcome to the Free Fire Zone. President Obama is out on the stump trying to sell his nuclear deal with the Iranians. The problem he's got is the Iranians are throwing BS flags on all his major selling points. But like any good pitchman, he doesn't let those pesky facts get in his way. He'll distract you with some awesome analogies like this one.
Sort of like you've signed a contract to purchase a home, but you've still got the appraisal, the inspector.
Well, Mr. President, if this is akin to buying a house, then it's like buying a house with a meth lab in it from the meth dealer himself and then taking his word for the fact, oh no, I stopped cooking crystal here years ago. But all your friends keep pointing out all the meth heads congregating on the front porch and that nasty smell coming from the garage. No, we're not buying any of this, Mr. President. Matter of fact, we've heard this tall tale before.
I'd like to say just a word about the framework with North Korea that Ambassador Gallucci signed this morning. This is a good deal for the United States. North Korea will freeze and then dismantle its nuclear program.
We have achieved the framework for that deal. And it is a good deal. A deal that meets our core objectives. This framework would cut off every pathway that Iran could take to develop a nuclear weapon.
How'd that whole good deal thing work out with North Korea? That's right. They've got nuclear weapons. Bravo. But wait, there's more. Obama trots out political tool. National security expert Ben Rhodes to point out they'll be doing inspections like a Marine Corps drill instructor.
Well, Jake, first of all, under this deal, you will have anywhere, anytime, 24/7 access as it relates to the nuclear facilities. So if it's a suspicious site that we believe is related to its nuclear efforts, we can get access and inspect that site through the IAEA.
Oh, I get it. The IAEA is going to make sure they don't get a nuke. Is that the same IAEA that stopped little Kim from building his nukes? Let me show you how that whole UN and IAEA inspectors thing actually plays out.
Peter, Hans Briggs bought it, so they come.
Mr. Earle, I was supposed to be allowed to inspect your palace today, and your guards won't let me into certain areas.
Hans, we've been through this a dozen times. I don't have any weapons of mass destruction, okay, Hans?
Let me see your whole palace, or else.
Or else what?
Or else we will be very, very angry with you. And we will write you a letter telling you how angry we are.
Okay, I'll show you, Hans.
This deal is nothing but a glide path to a nuclear-armed Iran. Kill the deal, keep the sanctions and make them stronger, and stop Obama from perpetrating this national security fraud on the American people. I'm Jim Hansen, and you've been in the Free Fire Zone.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back. I'm very pleased to say, joined as we are each week by a longtime syndicated columnist, now blogger par excellence and best-selling author Diana West. She has, of course, brought to us Death of the Grown-Up and American Betrayal, the secret assault on our nation's character. Diana West, welcome back. It's good to have you with us as always.
Always good to be here with you, Frank.
You have been writing for quite some time about a very courageous leader in Europe who has provoked great controversy, but done so in a way that I think has been quite salutary in terms of really showcasing what's happening in Europe and what may be in prospect for us as well, if we're not careful. Talk about the latest experiences and efforts of Geert Wilders, the Dutch parliamentarian, to warn about the rising tide of jihadism within Islam and Europe.
Yes, well, it's an amazing thing because I am, in fact, the second American to have interviewed Geert Wilders back in about 2008. The first being, I believe it was Greg Palcott of Fox News, who was so shocked by hearing the facts and truth and experiences of someone experiencing Islamization in the heart of Europe, that it's quite an interesting clip of video. He's utterly appalled hearing the facts coming at him. And this is something that Geert has always, always adhered to and promoted and amplified. And he started as a party of one back then. And right now he is the most popular or almost the most popular party in the Netherlands in the polls. And this has come at a great cost, both to him personally. He lives under 24/7 protection under threat of assassination from Islamic militants and terrorists and so on. And also his own government, which is trying to shut him up and has brought various legal cases against him on the grounds of things related to what is known Orwellianly as hate speech.
Yeah. Our guest is Diana West. You can find her writings at dianawest.net. Also, her best-selling books, Death of the Grown-Up and American Betrayal, at Amazon and bookstores across America. Diana, you were talking about Geert Wilders' truth-telling, which has been and I guess is continuing to be treated by the authorities in his own Netherlands and elsewhere in Europe as, quote, hate speech, unquote. Talk a bit about what it is precisely he's saying that is getting this kind of treatment and what has been entailed for him personally and politically as a result.
Yes, well, the basic, crunching his message down, as he is very wont to do, his message is basically the more Islam there is in society, the less freedom there is. And this is something that he has witnessed, that we've all witnessed, but particularly in Europe, we have seen the encroachment of Sharia laws and Islamic customs and so on that have actually reduced the measure of liberty to freedom of worship, freedom of speech, and other liberties that we all hold dear, particularly our European cousins as well. And most recently, the thing of it is that you mentioned the authorities, and that's exactly right. The elites, the authorities, the entrenched power blocks, these are his enemies. They make common cause with the Islamic masses in Europe, with the political forces against freedom, for socialism, for Islamization, and he is sort of monkey in the middle. However, he is very popular, and his message is popular, and indeed it is resonating across Europe, and this becomes a great concern to these same authorities. Most recently, he was in Austria, in Vienna, which, as you noted earlier, is an historic place that most Americans are not really aware of. This history is not really part of our lore that we have retained. This was, of course, the site of the famous Battle of the Gates of Vienna, where Christian armies, led by the Poles, actually, stopped Islam's advance into Europe into 1683. Which is not that long ago. I mean, it's a long time ago, but it's definitely modern history, and it was quite a flashpoint. Anyway, he gave a similar speech to many he's given across these years, and now we have an Islamic group, the leader of a Muslim organization in Europe, asking the public prosecutor in Austria to investigate Wilders for essentially another form of hate speech, denigration. This translates into speaking honestly about Islam, speaking honestly about the impact of it, and speaking honestly about the conflict between the West liberties and what Islam brings, and asking people essentially to reject it.
Diana West, let me just ask you, because invariably the question arises when one makes these sorts of statements, whether it's you or Geert Wilders or me or others, that we are painting all Muslims as adherence to this program. I have come to describe it the way its adherents generally do, which is as Sharia. That seems to be sort of at the crux of this charge, that he's denigrating people or engaging in hate speech against all Muslims. To the extent that he makes the distinction, or you make the distinction, between people who are faithfully following what the authorities of the faith, and I think this is important to say as well, say is the faith, is there not a risk of actually implicating people who do not, at least at the moment, agree with this Islamic supremacist program, and in so doing, implicate them in what I think is quite rightly a description of a very serious problem posed by those who do have that supremacist agenda at heart?
Well, I think that they are largely irrelevant to the issue, because it's really not up to me. I can't speak for Geert Wilders, of course, but it's certainly not up to me to know what is in the minds of any mass of people. All I can look at is the texts, is the law, is the advance of Sharia into what I consider my sphere, my Western sphere of liberty, which is at odds with this program. So it's really not for me to say or judge or really care, frankly, about the concerns of people who follow this, if they want to separate themselves from this extremely, barbaric mode of life, certainly in the 21st century. That's their problem. That's their issue. That's their concern. That's a whole other story. What I think Westerners need to do is focus on the impact of Islam itself according to its authoritative texts, according to its history. We have centuries to examine and compare, and the parallels are terrifying, because we've seen this is just another recurrent cycle of expansionist Islam. And so again, the masses, the people, that's almost a separate concern, and it's probably a separate discipline. The role of a defender of the West, which I think all citizens must become, is to examine the implications of increasing amounts of Islamic worship in their countries, which come with an increasing Islamic demographic. And it's really not us to weed people out or determine what's in their hearts. How can one? It's not possible. But we can look at the texts, we can look at the laws, we can look at the history, we can look at the culture, and we can see how it is extinguishing our own and make up our own minds.
Yeah. It's been observed to me that there are good Muslims and there are bad Muslims, and the good Muslims are the ones who follow this program, according, again, to the authorities of the faith, and the ones who are not are considered bad Muslim, indeed apostates, and susceptible to murder. So most of them wind up going along with the program, or at least not raising the kind of opposition to it that you and Geert Wilders are calling for. Diana, very quickly, what is your expectation of what repercussions there might be from Hirt's statements in Vienna? Will he be prosecuted again?
I tend to doubt it, but I don't really have anything more than a gut feeling. I think he is in legal jeopardy again in his own country over a separate issue. I tend to think this was more political grandstanding, and I can't imagine it's going to go too far, but of course, you never know.
Don't underestimate these guys. The power of the forces of sort of accommodation to this Sharia program are not to be underestimated, at the expense of our freedoms, as you say so well. Diana West, as always, thank you. I'd hope to talk with you about Senator Tom Cotton and the imperialist presidency we're facing at the moment, but that's for another day. In the meantime, keep up the great work at dianawest.net, and we'll look forward to our conversation next week. Jim Hansen joins us next. We'll talk with him about the Iran deal and what it portends for all of us straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
We're all part of your community.
We all play a role in keeping our community safe.
So protect your every day.
If you see something suspicious, say something to local authorities.
America's injured and critically ill service members face incredible challenges every day of their lives. Since 2004, the Semper Fi Fund has helped thousands of service members and their families with both immediate and long-term needs. Join the Semper Fi Fund in supporting American heroes. They've given so much. Now it's our turn. Learn how your tax-deductible donation makes a real difference in their lives at SemperFiFund.org.
This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. It was a pretty spectacular reminder of a fact most of official Washington tries to downplay, if not ignore. Our nation depends critically on electricity. If its availability is disrupted, even for brief periods, the impact can range from inconvenient to dangerous. Protracted, widespread disruptions would imperil the nation itself and many millions of its people. Yesterday, parts of official Washington, including the White House complex and State Department, went dark for a time. Fortunately, the mechanical failure at a single Maryland transformer substation triggered rapid workarounds and backup generators kicked in. We must not respond to this evidence of a yawning vulnerability with complacency and inaction. Physical sabotage, cyber attacks, electromagnetic pulse weapons, and intense solar storms threaten extensive, enduring blackouts. We must secure the grid now. This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Learn more at securethegrid.com.
There are many sounds in your daily life. Ones that make you smile. Ones that help you relax. And there are some sounds that can help save lives. Wireless emergency alerts, now on many mobile devices, use a unique sound and vibration to bring you critical information about emergencies in your area. With updates from local sources you know and trust, you can be in the know wherever you are. Learn more at ready.gov/alerts. Brought to you by FEMA and the Ad Council.
When we decided to rename this radio station, we came up with one word, one very big word, answer. It's because we know our listeners better than anybody. We know you wake up every day with an insatiable appetite for news and information. But more than that, you want to know what to make of it all. No matter what happens, if it matters to you and you listen long enough, you'll learn what it means and different ways to think about it. That's why we're here. Do this better than any station in town. Welcome aboard. AM 1260, The Answer.
Ready to roll?
Go for it.
Hi, I'm Jessie Jane Duff. I'm a retired United States Marine Corps Gunnery Sergeant, and I served 20 years on active duty serving this great country. I'm with Concerned Veterans for America now. After I got off active duty, I realized I still wanted to be involved and help change the direction our country is going. Concerned Veterans for America offered me that great opportunity. If you want to get involved and you're thinking of getting involved, please visit our website because we have many activities throughout the nation. We have wonderful representatives in each state who are putting forward different ways you can become engaged. So go to the website at concernedveteransforamerica.org, and you do not have to be a veteran. But if you support the freedoms that we all fought so hard for to defend this great nation, then consider participating in the many activities we are participating in and helping to change the direction our country is going.
This is Frank Affney. You're listening to AM 1260, The Answer.
Now more with Frank Affney.
We're back, I'm pleased to say, joined by our Executive Vice President at the Center for Security Policy, Jim Hansen, a man who has served his country in uniform in the Special Forces of the United States Army and is now rendering very important service with us at the Center for Security Policy, our Secure Freedom operation. Jim, you have just issued a marvelous new video that is in the free fire zone. Talk about it and the takeaway that you're hoping people will get and how they can view it.
Well, Frank, right now, President Obama is out trying to convince America and the rest of the world that he made some sort of monumental, earth-shaking, world-saving deal with the Iranians. And he's got a number of problems with that. The biggest is the fact that the Iranians are saying, excuse me? The Iranians are issuing statements in Persian and to everybody who will listen to them saying that's not what we agreed to. So all of these marvelous things that Obama was saying, this will block every pathway, this will do that, you know, no one, the Iranians will never have a bomb and we'll all be safe. The Iranians are like, well, no, we didn't agree to that. And consequently, I think his path to any deal that actually gets signed is getting a little tougher, fortunately for all of us, because this is a horrible deal. And if we can stop it before it becomes reality, we'll all be better off.
Yeah, you know, Jim, I must tell you, I'm a little confused about whether there actually is a deal. I keep hearing about a framework agreement, but as you say, it's being described in both various statements and in fact sheets and other materials in ways that make it clear that there are at least multiple versions of this agreement and not a single one. What do you make of this? Is it in fact the case that there is some agreed, joint, and mutually understood text, or is this just really a dog's breakfast?
I think you're absolutely right. There is no deal. There's no signed agreement. There is no common set of facts that the Iranians and the United States agree to. The only people who potentially agree on this deal are Obama and Valerie Jarrett. They're about the only ones who are probably on the same sheet of music. Everybody else is properly baffled by the idea that somehow we're going to stop the Iranians from their path to a nuke by not taking away their centrifuges, by letting them keep the enriched material, by letting them keep their fortified underground locations. I mean, the funny thing is my video's got Bill Clinton making almost the exact same claims about the deal he made with the North Koreans. And I'm pretty sure that turned into a mushroom cloud. So I don't have much hope for this one.
It sure did. And you do a marvelous job of, you know, satirizing that with clips of the dear leader out of Hollywood. Let me just ask you, Jim, because it's sort of central to all of this. We're told that there will be this deal, an anywhere, anytime inspection capability conducted by the so-called International Atomic Energy Agency, or IAEA. Given what you've just said about the absence of a signed and mutually declared agreement, what are the possibilities that that kind of inspection regime is actually going to operate and in its absence that we're going to have a clue how far advanced this nuclear program of Iran's is?
Oh, we won't. I mean, that's the one thing you can pretty much guarantee is that the inspectors will never see anything Iran doesn't want them to see. Shockingly. You know, you've got a rogue regime that is building a nuclear weapon, and they're going to try and keep the inspectors away from it, and they will, because it's their country. They know where they hid the stuff, and they don't have to show anybody anything they don't want to. And that's the comical piece. They could sign this deal and agree to let the inspectors do anything, like political tool Ben Rhodes told everyone that they were going to, but that's not going to happen. It's never happened. They haven't done it yet. And they will hide what they need to hide and keep their breakout capability as close as they want it.
Yeah, and again, Jim Henson is our guest today. He is the Executive Vice President of the Center for Security Policy. And Jim, I guess that's really the kicker. This would be funny if it weren't so really serious. These guys are talking about, as you said very directly in your Free Fire Zone video blog, national security fraud. They're making representations about this deal that simply don't stand up to scrutiny. I just hope that the Congress of the United States is going to give it the scrutiny it requires and that the American people will not allow this fraud to be perpetrated upon them. Jim, let me turn to another subject. We were talking earlier in the program with Ryan Morrow about the Muslim Brotherhood, and I know you're following closely developments on the Arabian Peninsula, and we'll be talking shortly with Catherine Zimmerman about Yemen. But in the midst of the struggle over what to do about Yemen and the military operations that Saudi Arabia is now engaged in there, there are reports that the Saudis have decided that they're going to stop trying to take down the Muslim Brotherhood. That could have very far-reaching implications, both as they have been funding it for a long time and enabling its civilization jihad, particularly in the West. What do you make of this development and its possible implications for us?
Well, the Saudis don't need a two-front war. I mean, I think the Saudis are smart enough and sentient human beings so they can see what Iran is doing. I mean, Yemen is another example of Iranian expansion in the region. You know, they may not, the Houthis have their own set of beasts, let's be clear. You know, they have their own problems with the government, but the Iranians are giving them money, training, and arms, and essentially backing them. And the Saudis see that as another piece of expansion. They see the Iranians rolling tanks into Iraq at the behest of the Iraqi government to fight ISIS. So right now, the Saudis, the Egyptians, and everybody else is looking at whether or not the Muslim Brotherhood is going to be their problem internally, or whether the bigger problem is Iranian expansionism in the region. And I think they've determined that they're more worried about the Iranians than their internal problems within the Sunni community. And so they're trying to minimize those beefs and concentrate on the big war.
Well, and I think it's probably also fair to say, Jim Henson, that they are reverting to form, you might say, what they've long done, which is try to effect an arrangement whereby they are promoting, in fact, not simply tolerating, but actually enabling the Muslim Brotherhood and its operations elsewhere, as long as they don't bring it into the nation of Saudi Arabia itself. And so it's kind of the double game that they've played with us, among others, that they can, in fact, enable the global jihad, not simply try to make sure that it doesn't come home and upset their apple cart in the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. Speaking of global jihad, Jim, you have been very involved with the work that the center's been doing on trying to counter it with our Defeat Jihad Summit and the Secure Freedom Strategy. I wondered what your current reading is on what's been happening in Africa, specifically the Al-Shabaab attacks in Kenya and the Boko Haram operations in Nigeria, and whether at least the latter may now be on the run as a result of the election there.
I don't know if they're on the run. It's at least nice to see some of these African countries actually get mad about this and start taking the fight directly to these guys. But it's just not that simple. You know, I mean, the terrain in Africa and the capabilities of the, you know, the good guys, the nations that would be trying to shut down the jihadists, just aren't very high. So it's difficult for them to do anything. And it's compounded by the fact that now Boko Haram has sworn alliance to the Islamic State, to ISIS. So if you want to talk about a global caliphate, it's intercontinental. It's in, you know, Afghanistan and Pakistan. It's with Boko Haram. So those guys can start coordinating now, and I'm not convinced at some point they won't be sharing resources and planning together and creating an even bigger problem. So I don't think there's any reason to believe Boko Haram is in danger. They may lose some people. They control so much territory right now. They've got plenty of places to go to and hide, and the government forces there are in no way capable of maintaining control over all the places where Boko Haram currently has sway.
Yeah, I heard from Peter Pham yesterday that actually some shrinkage has been taking place in the territory controlled by Boko Haram of late. But I fear you're right, especially with the election of a guy who has his own Islamist record and has indicated his desire to bring Sharia to northern Nigeria. This new president of Nigeria, Muhammadu Buhari, we may not see the end of Boko Haram anytime soon. I know you'll be covering it closely in the Free Fire Zone and elsewhere at the work of the Center for Security Policy. Jim Hansen, we're very grateful to you for it, and come back to us again soon. Next up, Catherine Zimmerman joins us from the American Enterprise Institute. We'll talk more about Yemen and what's likely to happen there and its strategic implications for us. Straight ahead.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Every day, the men and women of the United States Marine Corps demonstrate their commitment to defend the American way of life. Since 1775, we have served our nation as a force in readiness. From combat operations to humanitarian assistance in every corner of the world. No matter where the mission takes us today, or wherever our country needs us tomorrow, we always remember the land we call home. As Marines, we take a stand for each other, for our nation. For us all, the few, the proud, the Marines.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real special forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real special forces, ours need ammunition. And in the war of ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
I'm Robert Muse, co-founder and senior counsel of the American Freedom Law Center, our nation's premier public interest law firm fighting for your faith and freedom in courtrooms across America. Make no mistake, we live in a pivotal time. Secular progressives such as Barack Obama and his surrogates are zealously sweeping religion from the public square, foisting Sharia law and other harmful international precedents into our courts and constitution, assaulting the traditional family, and weakening our national defense by, among other things, undermining the strength of our military through social engineering and political correctness. But I can assure you that the American Freedom Law Center is aggressively engaging our nation's enemies with offensive lawfare to defend our fundamental rights and to fight stealth jihad in all of its forms, including the civilization jihad being waged by Muslim Brotherhood front groups operating here in the U.S. Indeed, there is no other public interest law firm as uniquely qualified to fight this battle. But we need your prayers and financial support to succeed. Please consider a tax-deductible donation to support our critical fight for your faith and freedom. Visit us at www.AmericanFreedomLawCenter.org.
I'm Fred Fleitch with the Center for Security Policy. One of President Obama's worst foreign policy failings is the lack of a strategy to defeat Al-Qaeda and ISIS. These terrorist groups are part of a global movement to establish Islamic supremacy and Sharia through violence. This movement is called the Global Jihad Movement. It will not be defeated without a strategy that recognizes its true nature. In January 2015, we issued a comprehensive strategy to defeat the Global Jihad Movement. It is called the Secure Freedom Strategy and is based on National Security Directive 75, the strategy that President Ronald Reagan used to defeat the global totalitarian threat of his time, the Soviet Union. Like President Reagan's strategy, we lay out a comprehensive plan on how the United States government can be reorganized and focused to understand and defeat the global jihad movement. You can read the Secure Freedom Strategy at securefreedom.org, or you can purchase a copy on Amazon.com. I'm Fred Fleitz.
This is Jenny Thomas. I do video interviews of leaders with the Daily Caller. I had the privilege recently of interviewing Diana West about her extraordinary new book, American Betrayal, The Secret Assault on Our Nation's Character. You can see it at dailycaller.com. American Betrayal reads like a spellbinding historical thriller, but it is also a carefully documented account of how the U.S. government was penetrated by communist agents in the years after President Roosevelt normalized relations with the Soviet Union. Diana West shows how a similar assault is being mounted today by yet another collectivist ideology, the supremacist Islamic doctrine of Sharia. She establishes that while the communists and the Islamists may have very different visions of the world, they have employed the same techniques to defeat America. Please watch my conversation with Diana West about American Betrayal, then check out the other great leaders we profile at dailycaller.com.
Annie Soldier Incorporated was started in August 2003 as a simple family effort to help the soldiers in one Army unit, thus the name. However, due to overwhelming requests, on January 1, 2004, the Annie Soldier effort was expanded so it would include any member of any of the armed services in harm's way. Won't you please help? Find out how by going to www.anysoldier.com today.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back. I'm very pleased to say joined by Catherine Zimmerman. She is a research fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, where she specializes in and really runs their Al-Qaeda analysis in the Critical Threats Project at AEI. She has a lot of great material at criticalthreats.org, which I commend to you, about both Al-Qaeda and Yemen, a country in which she's developed considerable expertise. Catherine, welcome. It's great to have a chance to talk with you at a moment when all hell seems to be breaking loose in Yemen.
It's great to be on the show.
A full employment program, needless to say. Well, welcome. Let's talk first of all about Yemen. What kind of a place is it on a good day? Its strategic location is particularly interesting to me. And then sort of how have we gotten to the present state of affairs?
Yemen has historically been an unstable country and has been described as on the brink of collapse for many years now. It's always been a somewhat managed chaos. The question of how we got from managed chaos to what some might describe as actual chaos or emerging civil war in Yemen today is a great one, and it actually traces back to the outcome of the Arab Spring and the negotiated agreement that transitioned power from former President Ali Abdullah Saleh to his vice president, President Hadi, who is now in Riyadh, Saudi Arabia. The transition agreement was really designed simply to bring about some stability and then for everyone to address all of the grievances and the political and economic marginalization that Yemen's multitude of opposition groups have against the central government. One of those groups was the Al-Houthis, and that kind of set in motion what we can see as the Al-Houthi push for control or more control of the Yemeni central government.
And describe, if you would, a little bit about the Houthis and their principal sponsor at the moment.
The Al-Houthis are a Zaydi Shia group, and their stronghold is in North Yemen. It's important to note that though they are Zaydi Shia, not all of the Shia in Yemen are Al-Houthi supporters. And you know, from the U.S. perspective, the concerns really are not their religion, but the fact that they've received considerable support from Iran. They've received funding and weapons shipments, and their allegations that they've also received military training and have advisors. So clearly that's a concern when we're looking at the potential for the establishment of a proxy group in Yemen. They're not there yet, but obviously it's concerning long term.
And Catherine Zimmerman, we're talking about a country that is, as I say, strategically situated on sort of the end of the Arabian Peninsula with much of its coast along the Red Sea, giving a group or hostile power, perhaps Iran itself, a vantage point from which to exercise conceivably control over a vital waterway, namely the entrance to the Suez Canal and all that goes through it, from oil and other products to our warships, making possible the avoidance of the having to sail all the way around the African continent in order to put forces into place in the Middle East as needed. To the extent that Iran is indeed aspiring to use the Houthis to engineer such an advance in their strategic position, how fast could they do it, in your estimation? Could they begin to exercise control over the Red Sea? And give us a sense of what the strategic implications might be.
The Houthis would not be able to control the Red Sea in the manner that you're suggesting, simply because Yemen's Navy and Coast Guard are not to the level that they need to be. The concern is, of course, as you mentioned, the Iranian Navy using Yemen's ports as a base and having a freedom of movement to patrol those seas. Right now, what we're seeing is the deployment of Egyptian and Saudi warships along with Iranian warships to that area in order to assert authority. From the American perspective, obviously we're looking for continued freedom of the seas to protect that key economic route and trade route up into the Suez Canal, and you know, see this as a concerning development as the conflict progresses because of the impact on trade over the waterways.
And do you agree with Lieutenant General Mike Flynn, the former director of the Defense Intelligence Agency, who described what's happening there now, in part, as you say, as a result of the engagement of the Saudis and Egyptians and others, not just with naval forces, but using airstrikes, as basically an unfolding, or at least part of an unfolding, regional sectarian conflict between the Sunnis on the one hand and the Shia? And if so, is it your estimation, Catherine Zimmerman, that we're going to see this thing, well, greatly expanding in terms of the areas engaged in conflict, civil war or otherwise? And if so, again, to what end?
The expansion of the region's sectarian war to Yemen is obviously a major concern. And it's, you know, clearly Iran and Saudi Arabia are both looking at Yemen as a fighting ground for this conflict. The difference, though, is that Yemenis still are trying not to see the fight inside the country as sectarian. Yes, the Al-Houthis are Shia, but they're also receiving significant support from non-Shia factions all based on local political objectives. So inside of Yemen, it's not fully sectarian the way that we see the war in Iraq or Syria today. But from the supporting standpoint, you have a Sunni Gulf Arab coalition that is conducting airstrikes against a force that has received Iranian support. So yes, from the external dynamics, we do have that component.
And obviously the potential for that sectarianism to become much more pronounced in due course. Catherine, I know this is a hard question at a moment when, as you say, what we're confronting is growing chaos, not just, managed, but unmanaged in parts of, if not most of Yemen these days. And, of course, in the mix is the group that you've been particularly concerned about, namely Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. But what is your counsel for the U.S. government at this point in terms of what we could usefully do and should usefully do at this juncture, given all of these various factors and forces at work?
Unfortunately, as this conflict has unfolded, the options for the U.S. government to influence it or even to protect interests, and here I'm talking primarily about the regional stability and freedom of the seas and preventing a terrorist threat that emanates from Yemen, has diminished significantly.
Especially with our withdrawal from that country, right?
Yes. And, you can look at the timeline and see when the U.S. withdrew all of its personnel, and that really set in motion the series of events that led to the Saudi airstrikes. It was the retreat from a military airbase in the south that the al-Houthis then took and used to push on Aden, which caused the Saudi intervention. So when we're looking at partners on the ground, it's really not clear who we would have. We're still backing President Hadi, but he doesn't control the entire Yemeni military. And many people are starting to disavow support for Hadi simply because he's seen as supporting Saudi airstrikes that are frankly harming the population and driving a humanitarian crisis inside of his country.
Yeah. Well, and there's good reason for seeing that way, given that he is, in Riyadh at the moment and presumably not only a guest of the royal family, but also very much active in promoting this activity in Yemen. It is a fascinating and vexing and very problematic issue on which your expertise is greatly appreciated. Catherine Zimmerman at the American Enterprise Institute, I hope you'll keep coming back to us with updates as this develops further and any ideas you have as to what we might usefully do about it. I hope the rest of you will come back to us again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.